Right. So for the sake of the recording, call this curing the spiritual illness that causes dukkha. So if any of you are in the practice intensive groups, then you will be familiar with this topic. It's been part of the exercise that we are doing right now. So it's been on my mind and I've been thinking about it, ways that people understand it. So that's this talk has come out of that. So I want to make 4 points today. And there's part of me just like, if you want to write these down and post these where you can see them, that would be great. One, and I'll explain a little more about each one. One, the purpose of Buddhist practice is to end dukkha. Two, dukkha is a feeling of existential dissatisfaction that has a range of manifestations. So that can go from real suffering and anguish to stress to a vague sense that things are not as they should be, to a very subtle feeling of alienation from yourself or from others or from reality. So like this, it's dukkha is often translated as suffering, but it's about unease. So it can be acute, but it can also be very very subtle. Three, it's experiencing pain and discomfort are an inevitable part of human life. But dukkha is a symptom of a spiritual illness that can be cured. So, for the sake of those who are trying to write, experiencing pain and discomfort are an inevitable part of human life. But dukkha is a symptom of a spiritual illness that can be cured. And I'm probably going to end up doing a podcast episode on this too. So, Or Buddhism offers a holistic approach to ending dukkha, including maximizing our overall spiritual health, managing symptoms, and curing its ultimate cause. So the purpose of Buddhist practice is to end dukkha. Hopefully for the podcast episode, I'll be able to find it. I looked briefly this morning, but I wasn't able to find where in the Pali Canon, basically, I don't know, somebody's questioning the Buddha about his goals and whatever. And he basically says, I'm here for one purpose, and that is to end dukkha. So, I mean, there's many different ways to phrase that, but ultimately. And this goal is not just negative. It can sound kind of, like I'm just here to end the then what, right? And I feel like Mahayana Buddhism does a good job of pointing toward the then what, right? When we may or may not think much of our dukkha. We may think it's just something that we can endure. It's not that big a deal. Okay, so I feel a little existential angst, whatever. I feel a little alienated from myself. It's not that, but the point is that is a symptom of a spiritual illness, which, if cured, brings us much greater peace. Lets us be at home with ourselves, awake to reality, more connected to everything. So it's not just a matter, I guess, in a way of like, it's not even necessarily that the dukkha is so awful. It is that it's a symptom of a spiritual illness. That if we cure that illness, we will be really glad we did. And number two, that dukkha is a feeling of existential dissatisfaction that has a range of manifestations. And so this is, when they have the Four Noble Truths, which is dukkha exists. The second noble truth is the cause of dukkha is often translated as desire, but it's basically wishing for things to be other than how they are. And the more that we wish that, the more it turns into a craving or a thirst, the more intense our dukkha. And then the third is that can end. Like if we let go of that desire for things to be different, that dukkha can end. And then the fourth noble truth is the Eightfold Path, which is how we do that. So the first step in that process is acknowledging, becoming familiar with our dukkha, gross or subtle. So that's what we're doing in the practice intensive groups right now, is just let's turn our binoculars of mindfulness on to dukkha. Where does it arise? What does it feel like? How does it manifest for you? When does it tend to manifest? What tends to be going through your mind when it manifests? Like curiosity about this symptom of a deeper spiritual illness. And we do experience dukkha no matter our practice. We still experience this. I mean, I still, it kind of sounds kind of silly even to say, yes, I still experience this. It's preposterous to me that I wouldn't, but the intensity of it can change, and I will get to that later. So then, three, experiencing pain and discomfort are an inevitable part of human life, but dukkha is a symptom of a spiritual illness that can be cured. So the most helpful image that I've found for this is from the Pali Canon, and it's the parable of the two arrows. So you get shot with an arrow. That arrow is physical pain. It maybe it's emotional pain. It's loss. Something happens. It's stress. It's whatever. Like you, that's difficult and challenging. Political situations can be challenging, or human relationships can be challenging. So that is, you're getting pierced with an arrow. Now, dukkha is we like. It doesn't actually say this in the sutra, but like I think you pierce yourself with the second arrow, or as people often said, or the third or the fourth, and that's like the example that the Buddha uses in this sutta. It's kind of like, okay, so you get pierced with this arrow, and you're like, why me? Who shot this arrow? Are they going to shoot more arrows? I don't know that I can recover from this. Like I mean, we compound the pain and suffering with our own mind. So, dukkha, and then this is, and there are other places though in the canon, and actually the whole concept of dukkha is not just limited to Buddhism. Other Indian religions had this as well. Like, so it's often described as like anything difficult, like pain, old age, disease, and death is dukkha. But it's really like those things tend to get our dukkha going, right? So still differentiating between like pain or discomfort, which is just what it is. And I think many of us have experienced this kind of thing where we feel a loss or something like that, a setback. And grief is a great example where we feel that pain. And if we're not adding a bunch of stuff to it, if we're not tormenting ourselves with it, it has a purity and a simplicity, that pain. It's not, it hurts. We might want it to go away, but it's okay, right? It's not knotting up our gut and stressing us out and making it. It's just what it is. So, pain versus dukkha. Dukkha is a symptom of a spiritual illness that can be cured. And we get more into how that is so. And then, four, Buddhism offers a holistic approach to ending dukkha. So, this is our topic for today. So we address our spiritual illness like we would a physical one, holistically, whatever helps. So I was seeing this, at least today, as kind of there's three different approaches. to dealing with our dukkha, dealing with our and the underlying illness. One I'm calling maximizing our spiritual health. So this naturally relieves some of our dukkha and also makes us more able to work with the other approaches that I'm going to get to. So this would be, and our spiritual and physical and emotional health are not separate. So honestly, your dukkha can be relieved to some extent by eating a good diet, getting sleep, getting exercise, taking whatever medications actually help you function, good work-life balance, warm, supportive human relationships. Those kinds of things can have an effect on our dukkha level, if you will. And then we, of course, have our specifically Buddhist things. We develop a practice, a strong practice, assemble habits of sitting zazen regularly, of coming to participate with sangha regularly, of, maybe you do dharma study, maybe you come to retreats, maybe you practice mindfulness during your day. So there's all these things that are just, they're not aimed directly at your dukkha, they're just building your spiritual health and grounding. There's part of this is seeking beneficial conditions, avoiding situations that exacerbate our dukkha or encourage negative thinking and behaviors, seeking out supportive and positive conditions and people. And it also includes our moral behavior. I mean, there's, we have altruistic motives for our moral and generous behavior, but it's also true that if we are lying and stealing and misusing intoxicants and, cheating on our spouses and whatever, like we're going to create more dukkha for ourselves and others. So moral behavior is another way of maximizing that spiritual health. So then we get on to what I'm calling managing symptoms. So the symptoms, dukkha is a symptom of the underlying spiritual illness, and it arises and passes away. So when we find it arising, we learn to recognize what's happening. We might learn the signs of dukkha coming on. We might kind of learn what it is, what's smart to do to kind of not go down that road. Just sometimes just even recognizing it for what it is enough for it not to, to dissipate or at least not be as bad. I mean, I was really just exhausted and stressed out the other day, just like, I don't know, just kind of got to that point where I was kind of like, everything sucks. No, I suck at everything and this isn't gonna work. And I would just but I didn't notice kind of like, okay. Just chill for a little while. Just put everything down. You're just feeling kind of overwhelmed. So I didn't believe it, right? I just kind of, let it be, let it pass. We become familiar with what makes it worse. The Pali Canon talks a lot about appropriate and inappropriate attention. So you notice, when if you're if you sense that you are really perseverating on ill will towards someone you think has wronged you, sitting and thinking about that person and while they have wronged you is not, that is not going, going to make the dukkha go away. It's only going to make it worse. So can you shift your attention? And this shifting of our attention is a very it's a very potent spiritual tool. It's one that I think many people it's a favorite go-to for many of us. So maybe we're feeling ill will, so we do some metta practice. or we're feeling kind of self-critical, so we go for a walk and exercise, or we're feeling kind of depressed and disconnected from ourselves, so we sit some zazen, right? Like we find out what works and what relieves that symptom of dukkha. Following the breath might reduce anxiety. Maybe reading some dharma helps, just helps us release some stuff. Doing some kind of activity that makes us feel calm. And this is all, and I think of that as managing the symptoms, right? When dukkha arises, what are the various things that we do to kind of free ourselves from that feeling? And this is all wonderful and helpful, and we need to continue doing that all the way along in our practice, maximizing our spiritual health and learning to manage symptoms. But we're missing a great opportunity if we don't remember Buddhism's promise that our spiritual illness, the root cause of our dukkha, can be cured. And if we do not address the root cause, the source, the symptoms of dukkha will continue to arise. So at some point, this little illness analogy breaks down because it's not an all or nothing thing, right? It's not like I've solved my spiritual illness and now no dukkha arises. I mean, maybe that's complete Buddhahood. I don't even know, honestly, if that's possible. Maybe it is. If so, it's rare, but it doesn't really matter. I know, as I think all of you know, that it is possible to relieve, like to make progress on this, right? To start curing illnesses or parts of the illness, if you will. It's not an all or nothing thing, right? We can work on it. So over time, our most painful dukkha is relieved, leaving more and more subtle dukkha for us to investigate. We're doing in the practice intensive group, we're doing a journal where we've been writing about our experience, certain experiences of dukkha. And I've been doing it as well. I don't always do that, but I kind of felt like I should have to take my own medicine. And somebody asked me, like, okay, you're writing about dukkha, like you've been practicing for 30 years, doesn't it go away? And that's a good question. And I basically would say it's just the dukkha gets more subtle, right? 30 years ago, the dukkha was freaking torture, right? The dukkha just tore me up inside and made me wonder if life was worth it. And now it's kind of like, I don't know. I don't feel quite like I'm doing this wholeheartedly. But there's as long as we're feeling dukkha, there's still some of that illness left within us. It's not something to be ashamed of. It's not a failure. It's just true. Pretty much as long as we're around, we're probably gonna have some degree of this underlying illness. But things can get much better. So, what are the root causes of our dukkha? What is our basic spiritual illness or multiple illnesses? So, according to the Buddha, and according to Buddhism and Zen, there's an answer to this. Wrong views. So this is radical. This is Buddha's radical teaching. What are the root causes of our dukkha? Wrong views. So sometimes this is called delusion or delusions, which are simply a false belief or opinion. I feel like that word has a It has some, I can't put my finger on it quite, but it has some connotations that I don't think really apply or don't always apply, maybe of kind of obliviousness to our wrong views. And that's sometimes the case. But sometimes I think we're well aware of our views and we just can't shape the view, right? We're like, we know we see things, but that's the way things are. Like you just so yeah. These wrong views, incorrect, not wrong as in morally wrong, but just in inaccurate, incorrect, false. So our wrong views can be about anything. And the ones that cause us the most dukkha are usually one, views we're not conscious of holding. And two, not rational. So there's like we're all carrying around just like a thicket of views. It's just the how we are as human beings. So we're trying to, delve down and become familiar with our underlying views or maybe values. So here's a few examples. There is something inherently wrong with me. There is something inherently wrong with other people. Like they can't be trusted, or they're out to get me. If I work really hard, I will always be safe, insulated from any misfortune. I mean, if we say that out loud, we'll kind of be like, oh yeah, well that yeah, I know that's not true. But at some level, we can still be holding and operating on that view. If we let go of our mental map of reality, we will fall into a void or cease to exist. I've held that view. I think to some extent I still do, right? Like maybe I'm not quite as attached to my mental map. Maybe I kind of see through it a little better, but have I let go of it completely yet? I don't know. If I can only figure out how to communicate my needs to my loved ones, they will meet those needs and I'll be happy. They just don't understand. If I could just get across what my needs are, then they will meet them. For that matter, here's a view like they can meet these needs that I feel. The life choices I have made require me to carry a burden of shame. So the list goes on and on. So curing our spiritual illness means rooting out the cause of our dukkha, finding that wrong view, investigating and questioning that view. And sometimes it will fall away like a butterfly shedding its cocoon. Sometimes once you see the view, you're like, that's bullshit. Like, why was I hanging on to that? Like, so that's kind of nice. I mean, sometimes that's all you have to do is just see it and it can release its hold on you. And sometimes we will see maybe that the view still seems quite convincing, but we recognize that holding on to it just is making us miserable. So, like, I don't know. Like my example was, I don't know exactly how to phrase it, but I had a Dharma brother who clearly disapproved of many of the things that I did and said and everything. And maybe I could phrase the view as if I could figure out and do what he approves of, I will be a good person. Like I will be okay. And when I recognize that, that I was holding that, I'm kind of like, I realize I can't see into his head. I don't know what he's think. I can't operate like that. I just can't. That just does not work. So, like, I decided instead to just kind of pretend that he loved me. To just like kind of just I'm just gonna give him the benefit of the doubt and just, he has his moods sometimes, but overall he loves me, and I think he did. Right. And then like the whole dynamic of our relationship changed because he wasn't seeing me like looking for his approval anymore. So he was able to chill out a little bit, and everything just really shifted. And I'm kind of like, oh, that's cool. I mean, that caused a lot of misery over the years. So, and sometimes we find our view and we can't let go of it yet. And then it becomes a koan for us to lean into, keeping in mind that if the view is causing dukkha, it is wrong. So leaning into like what is true. So we have that belief, like there is something inherently wrong with me, and that's causing me dukkha. Okay, so I know the Buddha's saying then that that's a wrong view, right? How could that? So what's the alternative, right? Like, what is true? Like, how do I know what my nature is? How am I judging wrong or right? Or, is it possible that I'm just a Buddha too? And so we lean into that. And then, of course, just wrap it up by saying we all share the fundamental delusion that we have a separate, independent, autonomous, inherent self nature. So there's all these various views that so like little like that's as many illnesses. There's an infinite many illnesses that we can cure, and it relieves dukkha. Then like that is one of the which has been identified by our Dharma ancestors. It's like the fundamental, the overarching delusion which causes us the most pain and difficulty. So that's a lot of what our practice is aimed at, is trying to deconstruct that view, trying to settle the mind, open up to another way of seeing things, studying the Dharma. So, yeah, I guess I'll leave it there and have a discussion. Bob.
Thanks, Domio. This has been a great talk. I appreciate it a great deal. One thing that came to mind is the struggle between delusion and deception. Other practices, other religions talk about being deceived by the great deceiver, putting the solution to somebody else. It's not me, it's somebody else, something else. And yet here we're talking about delusion, which is, I always put self ahead of that, the self delusion. Can someone be deluded by somebody else, or is that really deception?
That's a good, I mean, when I look at down that list of views, I mean, definitely see where other people or culture, there's a lot of places where we can get those views from, right? So we're partly responsible for the views that we end up with, but not entirely, right? So I think, I mean, I guess you could say then that we've been deceived by others, but as we now we are carrying that view, and that's like it's entirely within our it's not necessarily easy, but it's entirely within the realm of our choice to whether we our relationship to that view from now on.
Thanks.
Jessica.
So I have a question about wrong views that are not conscious. So in Jungian depth psychology, two key methods for discovering what those are because they're unconscious, are to pay attention to one's habitual patterns of behavior and thought and in what context they show up. And another one is to really pay attention when we have a strong reaction to somebody that could be somebody we've just met of aversion or attraction, either one, because certainly it's not about them. We know nothing about them. And I'm just wondering what the Zen path has to say about are those methods relevant and what else might the path offer to uncover what's unconscious about our wrong views?
Those sound, I've made those kinds of recommendations to people many times. So I think I am, it's going to take me a while to parse out how this, what I'm talking about today, aligns with my like 10 fields of Zen practice, right? Is it karma work? I don't know. I don't know exact. I don't know. That's like there's many ways to slice the Dharma tomato, and like I don't know, this is one of them. But that's you know, I feel like that's exactly what we have to do with the tools of mindfulness. You know, so I don't know if Jung read the Pali Canon, but it sounds like he got some of his stuff right from there, right? Because that's the Buddha talks about sitting and becoming aware that this has arisen, and you know, then what caused that to arise, and when this happens, that happens. And so I think we can be very, very deliberate about this investigation and use whatever tools there are at our disposal. I mean, sometimes counseling can help us, you know, ferret these things out. Sometimes just reflecting, but we are talking about a view we hold like right now. So sometimes what I like to do is recall a triggering situation, if you will, or it maybe not triggering, but like when this dukkha arises, and as I'm sitting, and okay, oh, I'm not technically doing shikantaza at that moment, right? I call that to mind, and I try to call, be like, feel like I'm there, right? So kind of a, how did I feel? And really just investigate, like what is bo what bothered me? What did I want to have happen? What did I think was happening? You know, what did I think was going on in this person's mind? What did I really want? And my example recently was so I was with my parents, who I dearly love, and we're walking on the beach, the coast, ocean beach. And you know, it's a beautiful day, and I mean, it's just so precious. And I wanted my, I didn't, this is something I realized later. Okay, first I'll start with just the dukkha. So I'm walking along, and I'll be walking next to my dad, and I want to talk to him. Like, I want to have a conversation with him. And I'm kind of like, he's got a whole life. Like, right. Like, I want to know him better. I want to, but I can't think of anything to say. Anything that I would say is kind of skewed. I want to say, like, you ever afraid of death, Dad? Like, I want to talk to him about like practicey kind of stuff, right? And he would just be like, what? I don't know. I just had no, I had nothing to say. And I felt really ill at ease. Like, is there something lacking in me? I'm just not interested enough. Am I not, what am I doing wrong here? And I don't know. I mean, it's not a, again, this is dukkha, but it's not like, you know, earth shattering or anything. But then I sat and like reflected on it later. Like, what was going on there? Why was I ill at ease? What did I really want? And I realized what I really wanted was for my parents to know that I really, really love them. I want them to know that I care and I feel intimate with them. Like that I didn't want to be able to be a good conversationalist. I wanted to communicate my love and presence. And so when I saw it like that, I mean, I guess my view would be if you want to communicate your love and interest to someone, you need to like be a good conversationalist and, get them to talk about themselves and whatever. And then I thought about like I loved spending time with my grandpa. I just loved it. He never asked me about my life. Never. I mean, with barely, he'd just be like, "Looks like it's gonna be warm today." I mean, that's about, but I loved it because I knew he loved me. His full attention was on me. He was fully present with me. I didn't have to talk. I'm like, So what I'm not really, care so much about, like, I mean, I would love to be a better conversationalist, but I probably never particularly will be. So can I kind of let that go and realize like what I really want is just to communicate my care. So that's one of my examples of kind of, and I think I like to think that subsequently, when I am with people and I can't think of anything to chat about, I won't feel inadequate and stressed. I will more just be like, just be with this person. James. And then said.
You were talking about progress and how you measure it, or how you can observe it. Maybe measure is not the right word, but how you can see the progress as you deal with suffering. And I get examples of that every day because I've got kids, and my son is going to be 15 in a couple of weeks, and so the first part of his life was before I came to practice. And now the latter part of his life, so far, latter part of this phase of his life has been when I'm very much deep in the practice. And, my father was very much, I loved him. We had a great relationship. He was very stern, disciplinarian type. And so I found myself using that on my son, which didn't work because he's a very different person from me. I was much more of a, yes, father, whatever you say, father, yes, dad, okay. And he's like, oh yeah, old man, you want to go? Like he's got that kind of attitude. And even at like 4 years old, he was like a, screw you, dad, and so that would just make me bristle. And I know I brought this up for the practice group too, but there was just that dynamic where I was just like, and it would make me even more mad, And then as I came to practice and I started to reflect on that, the suffering, that second arrow is very much a second arrow. Like I'm already dealing with this child and the dynamics of, what I'm perceiving as petulance, et cetera, but now I'm adding all this other stuff on top of it. And the relationship has definitely changed over the years. And it was just recently, he doesn't, he's a super good kid, but he still has moments. He's 14, of course. And I got on his case about something, we came back around to it. And I was like, I'm sorry, I probably got a little more mad at you than I needed to be. He goes, that's okay, Dad. He's like, you used to get mad all the time. Now you just get disappointed.
Wow.
I was like, it's working. Like it was just that immediate validation. I mean, a sort of validation that, oh my gosh, like it's okay. I'm seeing this actually manifest in real life. So I know I was super like, yes, I love you so. Of course, then he didn't want the hug, so
Delmeo and James, thank you for those last two stories. I think sometimes as modern Americans, middle class, who can afford to go for maybe some counseling along the way, we want to figure everything out and fix it rather than freeze sweet moments like, just being with people we love, and we don't need an agenda, especially if it's like our parents. But this author, Yamada's his last name, this Zen priest, based, wrote a lot of books. Each one I came across seemed to have gate in the title, about the Dharma gate. But at the end, he said, oh, having your practice will improve your overall health. And when I read, that's like a footnote at the end, and I thought, that's sweet. But it seemed disingenuous to me, and still does. But I can say, since I've been sitting since the end of 2018, surprisingly, some, you know, our shadow side doesn't always have anything but mild blinkers and shows up at unexpected times. So when they dim, it's sweet.
Thank you. Zen.
Thank y'all for sharing. I guess just listening to all of this, I'm thinking a lot about my life. So for context, I guess my biggest struggle right now is relationships, and specifically codependency. So like boundary issues, I guess, is one way to describe it. And there is a lot of ways, and like, yeah, a lot of ways to work with that. But one of the ways that I found helpful is when there is like a belief, a negative belief about ourselves or how the world works, and we don't know when this, where it's coming from, it's good to think about how is this belief actually maybe working in some ways? How is it used to serve us, maybe wrongly, but still serving us? So that can help us see how we can let go of it. I don't know if I'm making sense, but a good example could be maybe someone in a relationship, or maybe someone always seeks relationships where the other person is unavailable and does not value them. And on the surface, that's like horrible behavior. Why would someone do that? That's so hurtful to yourself. But then if the person sits down and thinks about it, they realize that they actually have a very low self-esteem. And so when they are with those people, they reinforce their belief and it feels right. And I felt like in my life, thinking through my beliefs in that way has been really helpful in just seeing like, oh, that's why I might think that. And then it helps to let go, just like seeing that pattern. Thank you for letting me share.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. That's a very good point. I mean, that's part of where I think it's helpful when we discover these beliefs, and sometimes they can just be like, they can seem quite silly or irrational or hurtful or whatever. But like, we don't need to feel bad about them or, you know, beat ourselves up for having them. They just ended up this way. And most of the time, like you're saying, they had some adaptive purpose at some point, right? Like somehow they were comforting, or you know, maybe it was the only way we could make sense of the world, or maybe it's just a hope we're really clinging to, like that sense that if I work really hard, nothing bad will ever happen to me, you know, like, you know, so there's reasons why we cling to these beliefs. But Coral.
Yeah, I want to talk about how. how important friendships and like people in your life are for dispelling delusion. I don't know if anybody's ever told you to calm down. when you're like really upset or kind of like invalidate you, and you just get like, oh my God, no, like this. But sometimes there's people in your life who can kind of like dispel, be like, that's not real, in like a very kind and supportive way. And Carson's not here, so I can embarrass him. But he's been that role for me. Like, he was the first person in my life where I'm like really worked up and I'm really suffering over something. And he's like, I can't, the way I repeat it even sounds like rude, but like, that's, I think that you're kind of overthinking this. And at first, you know, I resist that. He's challenging my worldview that this is a big deal. And then I realize he doesn't have any skin in the game. Like, why would he's not just telling me what I want to hear. And just having those people in your life that you can really trust to kind of tell you those things and realize that their intention is good, is just really nice. And yeah.
Thank you. It reminds me of my husband, who doesn't even practice anymore, but like I guess I one of my karma, I keep going back to this view that if I really try to do a lot, I will finish. And sometimes I ask myself, and then like and then we look, then I get to do what I want. Yeah, like I don't like, so it takes more unpacking, right? Sometimes there's like views and desires underneath the things that you're looking at. But I was just, you know, expressing my usual kind of like looking back at the day, like shh. And my husband, yeah, in that totally non-judgmental way, just said, maybe you just need to adjust your attitude. It was kind of like, okay, Zen Master. Jen and then Rachel.
I just wanted to know if you could speak about what if, I mean, it's good to know if you're wrong about someone not liking you, but what if you actually are correct that they don't like you or they're irritated with you and maybe they start expressing that to other people and everything? Is there a good strategy for that?
For what? How to relate to them from then on out, or
I mean, maybe if with your Dharma brother being irritated with you, maybe he really was, and like it didn't resolve as nicely as you ex in reality it happened for you.
well, but I was somewhat like maybe he was irritated by me, like so what?
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, that wasn't an easy place to get to, right? But like, I was more just like out of desperation. I was kind of like, look, I have spent years trying to please this guy, and I'm kind of like, you know, if it gets really bad, then he can let me know. He can let me know if there's something that he needs me to do differently. He can let me know. Of like they're. I don't know. Like that seems to me to be something probably many people have, but certainly women will have, of like, it's my responsibility to anticipate what you need and never upset you. As opposed to like, you know, I'm just gonna keep on doing my thing and you let me know otherwise.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Rachel.
I have a question about the investigation and being curious of dukkha and like investigating about like when it comes up and then point and then going down that rabbit hole. My biggest, I shouldn't say biggest fear, but I think no, I'm going to say it's my biggest fear is like going down a spiral but not getting out of it. You know what I mean? Like I'm my biggest worry is if I investigate this and I get curious about it, am I just going to be feeding into this more than healing it? And if so, what kind of strategies could be used to not have that happen, where I know you're supposed to like take a step back and try to observe, but if we're trying to investigate in things, aren't you trying to also put a whole lot of yourself into it? So how do you step back from that? What kind of advice would you give for someone who's wants to do something like that?
I think that's a really good question. And when I think about it, I guess it's like the best time to do that kind of inquiry is when you are feeling fairly settled and calm. So if you're all overwrought and upset, it's not really like it, then you're just gonna get caught in the substance of the dukkha, as opposed to being able to see anything like beneath it. So when I reflected on, what was going on when I was walking on the beach with my dad, I was literally sitting in zazen. I was literally like, feeling kind of calm, and then just like I want to learn more about this thing. I just kind of leaned into it and, led myself through that. So it is kind of like, that's what I was saying, like all of the things that we do in practice support each other, right? The basic spiritual health and the managing symptoms. So, if you can recognize after a while when you're doing the managing symptoms, like, ooh, my dukkha is really intense right now, I'm all overwrought, then, go do something that kind of calms you, or, follow the breath or something like that. And then, yeah, delve into that inquiry when there's more stillness, and and it's also like, there's a book from way back, I think it's like 60s or 70s, called Focusing, which is the only place that I've really read about this. But it was this pr kind of psycho, I don't know, not psychoanalytical, but it was a psychological process that you could do for yourself. You can call things up. And it really talked about a felt sense in the body, right? So this is really, you're really rooted in the body as you do this. You are asking, what is the view? And we're talking about right here, right now, not, how did that thing, why did that happen, and where did that come from? It's like, what is the view right here? So, it's like an internal investigation in this moment, because that view is still there, it's still alive within you. So then he talks about in this book Focusing, of just, when you have, for my, to use my words, like gained a little insight into it, you can feel it. You can feel the shift inside you where it goes, something feels a little different. Your relationship to this has changed. So I don't know, does that get at what you're talking about? Right, I'll wrap up. It's 12:15, sorry. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita.